This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Lee Young Lee grew up watching his parents recite classical Chinese poetry to each other as a kind of sport. In their home country, poets were considered noble figures on an almost spiritual path. So when Lee Young decided to become a poet himself, his parents were conflicted. Like most parents, they were worried about how he was going to make a living, but they understood the richer gifts he might find on his path. Today, Lee Young Lee is an acclaimed poet based in Chicago. He's giving a reading in North Carolina at North Carolina State University tomorrow at 7:30. It's part of the Owens Walters reading series. But first, he joins us on the State of Things. Lee Young Lee, welcome. Good to have you here.
Hi, Frank. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about that, your family history as a poet. Are you growing up listening to poetry?
Yeah, my parents were classically educated in China, you know, which meant they had to memorize large amounts of Chinese poetry and big tracts of philosophical writings, and so they could recite all that stuff. And I grew up listening to that, you know, being recited. And I remember the adults used to, when all my parents, contemporaries, and relatives would get together for dinner, and they would sit at a big round table, and at some point in the dinner, one of the adults would say a line from some ancient classical poem, and the adult to the right of that person would have to say the next line to prove that they knew the poem, and it would go round and round like that all night long. And I was just so impressed with it, you know, and glad that I didn't have to participate. And,
didn't get called out for not having done your homework. Your family's history also very interesting. You and your parents, a very interesting life story. Take us back to their days in China.
Well, God, it's really complicated. You know, my father came from a family of bankers and gangsters, quite frankly. And maybe there's no difference between bankers and gangsters. I don't know. But my mother came from an aristocratic family, and her grandfather became the first. He was the warlord for the Empress Dowager, and he eventually became the first elected president of China. And when she met my father, here he was, this, you know, kind of gangsterish Chinese guy dressed in Western suits and ties and hats. And she was impressed, and they got married. But my father ended up working with Mao very closely. And when they had a falling out, his life was in danger. And so my parents fled to Indonesia, where my father began teaching in a university. And, you know, every 12 or 15 years, the native population of Indonesia kills a bunch of Chinese. And we got swept up in that. And I was born there in Indonesia. And so my father was threatened and thrown into prison and nearly died. And we were put under house arrest. We were being shipped to a prison colony. And we escaped and eventually arrived in the United States. You know, Frank, that previous segment, it's still on my mind, man. It's just burning through. It makes me wonder about the nature of poetry and human suffering altogether. You know, when I think about my parents' suffering and the suffering of the man who just spoke so movingly, and it takes me back to this Chinese idea, you know, of safety and security. And they had this belief that the practice of art could win security in the world. I mean, this is what the ancient Chinese believed, you know, and they said that there's four levels of mastery or something like that in the martial art. And they said in the first level of mastery, you meet somebody and two things have to be present for that person to try to attack you. They have to have ill will and the daring to act. So if you have a certain level of mastery, you can win security for yourself by subduing that person. But the second level of mastery is the person feels ill will, but there's something about you that they can't work up the daring. And so they said that way you've won security for yourself without even hurting anybody. But they said that's a provisional kind of security because the person could, you know, return with friends or something like that and work up the daring. So the third level of mastery, they said, is winning security is to be invisible. Now, that's a strange thing for those ancient people to say, because I know we live in a time where everybody hates to be invisible. You know, we just want to be visible all the time. But they said there's an ultimate level of mastery of winning security and safety in the world, and that is you meet somebody, and something about your presence enriches that person. And then you've won security for yourself, for that person, and likely for the rest of the world if you've enriched that person's heart and mind. And they said the only way to do that is through the practice of art. Mm. And I wonder if that's just idealistic or is that true? You know, that.
Well, what would it be about the art? First of all, it would seem to me you would have to make an assumption about an essential quality in both of us. I'm just going to make these assumptions. You can swap them out of the park if you don't like them.
Yeah.
So that if for me to enrich you at our first encounter, we would have to have mm-hmm. There would be something in common. What might that be? Especially if we don't know the details of each other's story. Well, the one thing we can count on is that we both suffer. And so yeah. If we meet each other at our suffering, we know darn well that we've got something in common there, no matter what else we've got.
Right.
I mean, is that an assumption you could make? I'm just throwing that out there to a poet.
No, that's great. You know, I feel like I'm reaching for an answer, but I really don't know. You know, and I don't even know if I know that I know my own experience of suffering allowed me to connect to every other person on the planet. But, you know, there was something so moving about what the person was talking about was I realize also that suffering can isolate us, you know, can alienate us from other people. But at the same time, there's something about suffering that makes us just like everybody else. And so, you know, the speaker was, your guest was talking about how isolated he had become from his family and they were unable to speak about it. And, of course, I kept wondering, what if he tried to write about it or paint about it or write a song about it? Would that be clearer? Or is there suffering that is so deep that we don't have the social language for it, but we might have the artistic language for it? You know, because maybe social language, the language that we share with other people, maybe it isn't capacious enough or deep enough to carry all the multi-layeredness of human suffering. And maybe the only language that can... I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, is artistic language. Right. I don't know.
It's got, well, it's some form of symbolic language, right? I mean, we have to sort of get at it somehow. And whether or not it connects with you is one thing, but it may be an expression of at least a fraction of what I feel. Could I ask you to read a poem for us?
Sure. Okay, here's one. Maybe this is about suffering, I'm not sure. This is called Tearing the Page. And it's about watching my son. He was coloring in his coloring book, and you know, when he was very tiny, and he would press so hard, the crayon would go right through the page, you know. And he was taking piano lessons from my sister, and she'd taught him that mnemonic device, you know, every wise child. What is it? Every wise child deserves fudge or something like that. And he asked me if that was true. And I said, no. You know, I said, I prized myself telling him the truth. I told him every wise child is sad. That's the truth, you know. And so that's the first line of this poem. It's called Tearing the Page. Every wise child is sad. Every laughing child is forgetful. Every solitary child rules the earth. And the child who can't sleep learns to count. And the child who counts negotiates between limit and longing, infinity and subtraction. Every child who listens all night to the wind finds his breathing turns a wheel to leave no trace. And though he can't tell what a minute weighs, or if an hour is too little or too long, he's sure the play he's called away from each evening is the beginning and end of order in a human household. He knows his counting to himself and his rising and falling ball are appointed by ancient laws his own heart tides obey. But he can't tell anybody what he knows. Every wise child is heartbroken. Every wind-strewn flower is God tearing God. and the stars are leaves blown across his grandmother's lap. And of time's many hands, he can't tell the bloody from the perfumed, the hands that rip from the hands that mend. But he knows about goodbyes, some of them anyway. The goodbye at the front door each morning, a kiss for a kiss. The goodbye at bedtime, stories and songs until it's safe to close his eyes. And maybe he's even sat in the waiting room at Union Station, where dust and echoes climb to the great skylights, accompanied by farewells of the now going to join the farewells of the long gone. As old as night itself, he's not old enough in the morning to heat his milk on the stove. Old enough to knot his shoelaces, he's not old enough to unknot them. Old enough to know to close the window when it storms. Old enough to know the rain, given the chance, would fall on him and darken him, the way he himself colors the figures he draws, pressing so hard he tears the page.
Lee Young Lee reading his poem, Tearing the Page. He will be reading tomorrow at North Carolina State at 7:30, part of the Owens Walters reading series, here with me today on The State of Things. As you read that poem, in light of that, what you're thinking about now, the consideration of that last segment, does it change things? Are there insights in this poem that you hadn't had before?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, the whole thing about violence, about every wind-strewn flower is God tearing God, and I don't know. I don't know why that line stood out to me when thinking about. I don't know.
Well, it did to me too. If I may, the idea of God tearing God suggests the presence of the divine in everything, and that the sorrow and the tearing is also inherent in that. So anybody who thought God was the smiling God of Hallmark cards, got another thing coming. And the idea that wisdom comes from sadness and sorrow, that every child is sad and that the wise child is heartbroken. It's precisely the broken heart that brings the wisdom. It struck me as I heard you read. That's what
came to me. It seems to me, Frank, that the better part of getting of wisdom is what we call disillusionment, right? So we become free of our illusions. We have such a complicated relationship with that word. You know, nobody wants to be disillusioned. And I think, well, what do you want to be? Illusioned?
Right.
You know, so it seems to me that disillusionment is both a thing to celebrate. You know, we're getting free of our illusions, but at the same time, our experience of it is a sadness and, you know, having to say goodbye to our illusions, you know, about our illusions about human nature, our illusions about God, you know, or no God, or illusions about the world, about order and disorder, you know. Frank, it's so interesting. I'm remembering now, the ancient Taoists, they came up with a definition of a well-formed human being. And they said a well-formed human being stands in the marketplace, his cheeks smudged with dirt, a smile on his face, and he blesses what needs to be blessed, and he kills what needs to be killed. I thought, wow, that's such a disturbing, powerful, maybe true image of a well-formed human being, you know, and it's not a naive image. It's not a gentle image. It's not.
What happens in the Bhagavad Gita, right? Arjuna is arguing with Krishna. You're asking me to go out and kill my family. Isn't the way?
Exactly.
Doesn't this violate every principle in our Hindu culture? And you're telling me from the gods, this is the divine imperative now that I go out and do this. It's crazy. And
and
what does Krishna tell him? He says it's being able to do this without attachment to the outcome, doing it as a sacrament. And so how do we trust that we're disillusioned enough to actually act sacramentally without expectation of fruit? It seems to me that takes some real climbing down and getting away from.
Yeah. And, you know, the practice of, there's a whole culture of that, right? I mean, the Budo culture or the martial art culture in China, all of it is acting you know, they call it killing blow without ego, and it's sacramental, you know, and wow, boy.
To what extent?
I don't know why we're talking about that.
To what extent?
I don't know how we got into this.
Well, we got into it in the way that we must, and that is because this is an honest conversation about things that matter. And I only have time for just a little bit more, but I'm wondering about this isolation of sorrow and whether or not it's finding yourself with a deep sorrow that's inexpressible, almost ineffable, surrounded by people who are continually illusioned, right? I mean, we're ensconced in the pretense of this kind of jolly happiness instead of sort of sharing the sorrow and the isolation of that can be created by deep sorrow is just being surrounded by people who refuse to disillusion.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I'm wondering if there's something about our, you know, I have this sense, you know, if we spy on ourselves, we're actually manifold in self, and there's kind of language that we use in social settings, you know. And there's a kind of language that we use in private settings when we're with people that are intimate. And then there's a language we even use with ourselves when we're alone, we write in a diary. And somehow if all those three forms of language can't access or give voice to our suffering, it seems to me there's something poverty-stricken about those modes of speech. You know, and there's got to be a mode of speech where our suffering and our joys, our laments, are accounted for, and it seems to me like that would be art, you know, poetry, Shakespeare. I mean, you know, and so.
And Lee Young Lee, who will be reading tomorrow at North Carolina State. What a pleasure talking with you. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Lee Young Lee is a poet based in Chicago. He's going to give a reading at North Carolina State tomorrow, 7:30. It's part of the Owens Walters Reading Series. We have more information about it at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, the news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.